Well, after we talk a little bit about Cleopatra, we'll take your phone calls for the hour on Coast to Coast AM with Pat Brown. So get ready. My associate producer, Gina, thinks I have too much energy for the show tonight, so I think I'll bring it down a notch. Hi, Pat. How are you?
Hello. How are you doing?
Nice to be with you tonight.
Too much energy.
No, that's not me. Now, tell me a little bit about the murder of Cleopatra. I thought she did herself in with an asp.
Well,
a snake.
That seems to be the story for 2,000 years. Yeah, and it was a really odd thing because I did the Discovery Channel documentary on Cleopatra in 2003, went over to Egypt and studied what happened to her. And it was really quite amazing because I thought, nobody must have really ever spent time looking at what actually is claimed to have happened and to see whether it makes any sense. Kind of like I was saying earlier with when a police department gets really busy and don't have time to sit down and analyze a case. It's the same thing with this, although 2,000 years worth, you think a few more people would have analyzed a little more thoroughly. But history is kind of funny in that way. It's written and people repeat it. And oftentimes they don't step back and say, does this make any sense? So when I started looking into it, I realized that a lot of it didn't make any sense. And so during that documentary, I pretty much analyzed whether she could have died by a snake bite. And that my conclusion there was no. It was just not, that did not happen. There was no snake. And it's interesting.
She's assassinated.
Since that documentary came out, pretty much the books I've seen come out in Cleopatra have eliminated the snake. So I guess my argument was at least well-founded and well-received. But it was not the end of it for me because I looked at this and I said, I also don't believe she committed suicide. I believe she was murdered. And so that's what I decided. I would go back and reanalyze history and all about Cleopatra and her life and the death and see whether it made any sense that she committed suicide. And I don't believe she did.
That's amazing. That's great stuff.
Well, we'll see how it's received when the book comes out in February, and I'll see if I've made my argument well or not, because I'm sure it's going to be heavily analyzed by everybody else.
That means we don't have to wait two more years to have you back on.
There you go. You can have me on February. Yeah.
That's right. Super.
Let's wait to see how people receive it. I'm really going to be curious because I'm hoping one of the things I think is really neat about Cleopatra is she was such an incredibly strong woman. I mean, she might have been a little scary, actually. But, she in a very difficult time of Egypt's history, with Rome breathing down their neck, she managed to hold on to her position for 20 years and keep her country going.
How old was she when she died?
She was 41.
And she was still young.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't know. Was 41 young then?
Well, she's from the Ptolemies, and they have pretty good long lifespans. The first one, Ptolemy I, the first Macedonian pharaoh, he made it to 84. So he really was.
That was old.
Yeah, and he ruled for a very long time, 40-some years. So, she came from a pretty sturdy line, but it was a very difficult time for her to try to hold on as a female, try to hold on as an Egyptian, with everything was going on. And she inherited a kingdom that was on the downside because they were had already done a lot of sellout to the Romans. So she's in a difficult spot, and she just handled it extremely brilliantly. And I think that not enough has been written about how she managed all of that. And I just think, it would be nice to see young women growing up with quite an interesting, a much better story about Cleopatra than she was, lying around half naked with a snake attached to her breast.
Yeah, exactly. With people fanning her.
Yeah, and that she's kind of a slut that just was a vamp that got men and messed up their lives, and then she killed herself. I mean, this is all you can come up with for Cleopatra, who was a brilliant leader. I hope that so we can kind of repair history a little bit.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go east of the Rockies to start things. We'll go to Palm Harbor, Florida, and it's Bill. Hey, Bill, you're on with Pat Brown. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening.
Good to have you with us.
Hi, Bill.
Your guest is fascinating, George.
Sure is.
And as always, your program is great. I love it. Something that your guest, Pat, said in the beginning of the show kind of got me worried. I have a teenage daughter, and she's a senior in high school now. She'll be 18 in December.
Okay.
And she's an honor student. She goes to church. She's involved in a youth group at church. She worked all summer at a church youth camp. And
so far,
so good. Yeah.
Very grounded in her faith, you know. And I asked her, I said, why did you do that? You know, why did you choose to devote your summer to this camp? And she said, because it was at a camp just like that, that I came to know that the Lord loves me. And that just floored me when she said that.
Can you say that one more time?
That's all the upside of it. And, you know, and she was always a great kid. You know, her mother and I divorced when she was like 1 year and 2 months.
Well, it sounds like you've got a gem there, Bill.
So what are you worried about?
I was responsible for her every weekend, sometimes during the week, for 12 years.
Are you concerned about anything here?
No, but the thing that she said was sometimes we think they're so good and they're doing everything right, and then all of a sudden, you know.
Bang.
Well, no, I'm not. I didn't mean it that way. I'm saying that sometimes what happens is parents kind of bury their heads in the sand and say everything's just fine when they aren't really paying attention to whether their children are really happy and doing positive things and really doing okay. From what you're saying, it sounds to me like
a stellar kid.
He's doing really fantastically, yeah. I mean, we're not perfect parents, and our kids aren't perfect kids, and there can always be something, you know, they're going to tell you about in like 5 years, you know, or 10 years. They go, oh, guess what, by the way, Dad. You know, you have one, and you go, great, now you told me, but I'm glad I didn't know till now that you did this stupid thing, you know. I mean, I think that's kind of normal sometimes. But the fact is that she's doing all these positive things in her life. She's got all these, you know, she's really looking forward to her future. That's what you're aiming for. That she wants to, you know, she's happy and she's going on to something good. So I think it sounds like she's doing great.
Yeah. And you know what? You might as well cherish those moments too. Let's go next to John in Las Vegas, west of the Rockies. Hey, John, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having me. Yeah, it's good to talk to you guys. It's an honor. I work for a security and protective services, a Templar company.
Sure.
And I just want to ask, Pat, in your book, do you mention about the three Ds when it comes to, you know, protecting women, you know, disabled, dependence, and dread, which is what, you know, like a pimp or somebody who's trying to take over a woman's life, they use those three Ds.
No, it isn't in mine. I left that for somebody else to write about. No, those are good, though. I mean, you know.
Yeah, like
I think,
the first thing, like, I guess if, you know, out here in Las Vegas is kind of like the center for human trafficking. And in any case, if they find a girl that's already disabled, that helps them out, like runaways or so forth.
Right.
If they don't, then they'll figure out some way to disable them. Like, damage their car in some way, put water in the gas tank, or
whatever. Okay, I see what
you mean. Or mess them. If they got a good job, that doesn't help them. They want them to lose that job somehow, so they'll pull some strings somehow, and then they create a dependence, like depending on them for help with their rides, with getting work,
with everything.
Right.
Yeah, dependence on drugs, and then when they finally get their hooks in them, then they create dread, like, you do this trick for me or else.
Right.
Anyway, yeah, that was something I learned earlier on, and I see it happening around here, and it's really kind of horrible and disgusting.
Well,
you know?
You bring up some really interesting points. I don't use those particular words. They're really good.
But you use those subjects.
What I try to do was to take the parents back to why their child is even moving in that direction. Because like you point out, that disabled part, you know, you do not have a healthy, happy girl with positive things in her future suddenly end up in that situation overnight. And that's what some parents tell themselves, that, oh, you know, overnight my daughter was kidnapped by some sex ring, or overnight she met one guy and she just, you know, she was a hooker by the next week. It doesn't happen overnight.
No.
It happens because your daughter is moving in a direction which allows her to consider these possibilities, whether it be running away from home or whether it be, you know, selling herself for drugs because now she's a drug addict, or whether she's so desperate for attention that she's willing to do what a guy says. But it doesn't happen overnight. And so I try to, since parents are still in their teens' lives, I'm trying to get them to recognize that before they end up in the situation you're talking about with those 3 Ds.
Ted Bundy used to disable by, you know, faking a broken arm or something and having these people help him to his car.
Well, that's a different thing. That's a ruse that's used by serial killers. When you're talking about girls getting sucked into like prostitution, that it's usually, again, it's not an overnight thing. It's something that it becomes a downhill slide where the input keeps coming into their lives, which is, you know, pulls them in that direction. But a serial killer, if your daughter disappears off the street on the way to the store, just, you know, out of the blue, that's a serial predator. I mean, she's not probably going to be found alive, sadly enough, unless she's, you know, very lucky. But, you know, serial predators will use ruses, or they'll just jump out at you and get you. But, you know, they're not, it's something that, you know, I have a whole part in the book about that, too, what a girl can do to protect herself against serial rapists and serial predators. You know, so parents need to work with their daughters for that as well. But the bigger problems in life usually come with what our daughters are getting involved in.
I'm going to ask you something just infuriates me, but I might as well. And you're the profiler, the pedophilia priests. Do you ever look at that situation at all, Pat?
Well, I mean, it exists out there. Obviously, the pedophiles will always choose a group of kids who they can be alone with, who they can get a constant involvement with, whether it be through Boy Scouts, whether it be through coaching, a sports team,
right,
whether it be through religion, whether it be through foster care. It's a way to get that kid alone. Usually boys, it's a little different situation than the girls. Girls, they seem to have more problems with the people in their lives, like their mother's boyfriend, their uncle, their dad,
something
it's right
like
in their
that.
Own homes.
Good point. But, can't you spot these people? I mean, how does the church get them in? And then, of course, in many cases, they protected them by turning, the other way or not saying anything. But don't you see those telltale signs? I mean, how do you get involved in an organization and nobody know that?
Well, I think the problem is there's a thin line between liking children and liking children.
Well, right. Not every Boy Scout leader is a pedophile.
Exactly. They like kids. They want to help boys. They want to spend time with those boys mentoring them, right?
Yep.
The pedophile wants to spend time with those boys mentoring them.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's a very thin line between how close you want to get and what you want to teach them.
True.
So the rest of it looks the same. It's cheerful. It's helpful. It's I'm going to give my time. And it is very difficult to know the difference between the creepy dude and the not so creepy dude. So that's one of the things I again urge parents, if they can do so. One of the things I say is don't leave your especially this is a book about daughters, but don't let your girl go someplace and be with people you do not trust implicitly. And that's true actually for boys too. I mean, especially when they're younger.
Well, there comes a point though where you can't control them when they're at a certain age, right?
Well, yes, you can, because they're still your children. For example, if your daughter's, let's say your daughter's 15 years old. And
well, 15, I understand. No.
Yeah, 15, she wants to go spend time at some girl's house, and you do not trust who's the family at that home, the parents at that home.
Or you might not even know who they are.
Exactly, you might not know. And the thing is, if you don't know, why is your kid over there? So, yes, it's true that when your child goes away to college, 18 years old, moves out of the house, well, they're grown.
Is it tacky to say, okay, daughter, we're going over to see them and I'm going to talk to them? I want to basically interview them. I want to see how they live.
I think that's kind of pointless in my opinion.
You do.
Yeah, because, what does it really mean? I mean, I don't know people from meeting.
Well, at least you know who they are. You look around.
That's true, but if I'm going to leave my kid over there, I still want to know it's a safe place. That's just my opinion. I don't leave my kids any place that's not when they're growing up that wasn't safe, that I really knew the parents. Otherwise, they just weren't going to be there. There's a lot of places they can go, which is a group situation, or first of all, they got my home, they got the relatives, they got my friends who I trust, and they've got group situations that I trusted. So those are the things I aimed for, so that they wouldn't be off someplace.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea what was going on. And I know when we grew up, I mean, I remember running all over the neighborhood and going to people's houses. God knows what was in there. I don't know if it was that much better, or parents were just naive, or, you know, stuff happened and people just didn't say anything about it until too late. So some kids, you know, if they have been saying, you know, they were abused when they were back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
By one of their friend's fathers or something. Yeah. The parents didn't really know the family very well, and they were hung over there, and all of a sudden something happened. So, you know, we can't prevent everything. So it's not like there's a 100% solution. But I think we can tone it down. We can try to have the risk be just a lot less. And so instead of, you know, maybe, you know, try to have your daughter going to places that you do trust. Can you prevent everything? No, but you can. Is it going to be a lot better off than if she's at 20 different homes with people you have no idea who they are? You know?
All right, let's go to Aileen in St. Joseph, Missouri, first-time caller. Go ahead, Aileen.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hi, Aileen.
Hi, Pat. I was just going to share my experience with you both and
sure.
For anyone that's listening with the daughters. I was like 38 years old, and I was from St. Joseph, and I went to Platte City to meet a gentleman. So I'd have my car, you know, and meet him for a date. And he picked me up, and he took me over to Excelsior Springs. Now, you got to understand is that I had just moved in from Albuquerque, New Mexico, so I really didn't know where I was going. Mm-hmm. I was transferred to Overland Park, Kansas. But anyway, he was a coworker, and I met him at Platte City. He says, we're going to go get the boat, which was in Excelsior Springs. Well, I needed to go to the restroom. I went in. When I came out, he was gone. And this was about 9 o'clock in the afternoon, at night.
He was gone? He dumped you there?
He had actually left the gas station, and it was a real small gas station.
Oh, lovely.
Nice guy.
It gets worse. Well, anyway, I was sitting out there, and I wanted to go inside to the gas station. The gentleman says, I'm closing at 9. You need to leave. And he says, I'm locking up and going home. So I stood there, and I sat on the curb. Eventually, he never did show back up for like 20 minutes. But here came a car with like five young men.
Including this guy, or this is a different car?
Different person.
All right, hold on for a second. We're going to get the rest of your story, Aileen, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. I've got to hear the conclusion to this one. We'll be back. Okay, when we were last with Aileen from St. Joseph, Missouri, the guy she was with dumped her and left her outside of a station somewhere in the wee hours. And now a car of five people are coming by. Aileen, finish the story.
They came by, they got out, they asked me what I was doing, and I asked them, where am I? So that, I didn't know where I was. I was in Excelsior Springs, didn't know that.
Okay.
Because I was with my date. And anyway, they said, well, we'll take you back to your car. And I thought that, you know, they looked young, and I had a child myself. I said, sure. So anyway, I got in the car, and as soon as I got in the car, they said that what they were going to do with me.
Ugh.
Five men. Okay. And I thought they were kidding, and they were not kidding. They were not kidding. So anyway, what I did is I said, this is like 9 o'clock at night, and they kept riding around. Pretty soon they said, you buy us some beer. Take you to the car.
How old were you, Aileen? And how old do you think they were? You're 38.
38.
And how old were they?
They're around 18, 19, 18
okay.
years old. And whenever they told me their age, I realized, you know, they were young. I didn't even think anything would happen. However, they were chatting around and around what they were going to do to me. And whenever they said, get us some beer. We'll take you to your car. I got out, went into the convenience store, bought beer, but they all came with me.
Oh, yeah, I would have still, you should have made a ruckus right in there, don't you think, Pat?
I should have.
No.
I should have. Believe me, I was afraid.
Did they have a weapon?
No, they didn't. But, I mean, they were as close to me as some were actually touching me.
Well, I would have told the clerk, call the cops right now.
Right. Yeah, one of the things I want to advise to any women is, I use the term, go toward the light. Because anytime you go away from people, away from witnesses, to a dark location, to a lone location with one person or more than one person, that's the most dangerous thing you can possibly do. So you're better off taking your chances running toward anybody, any light, any place where there's people, than going in, away with somebody to their dark spot.
So, Aileen, did you get out of it or what? What happened?
Well, no, I did not. I went out to the car because I needed to get to my car. That's all I wanted to do. I didn't even know where I was. So anyway, I thought that I'd get the beer, and of course it was a lot of beer, and I thought that I was going to my car. It eventually, around 2 o'clock in the morning, it started having to go home. It left me with two. Finally, it left me with one. And he took me out to the country in a field. And what I had to do to get to my car was have sex with him.
That's called rape.
The rape, right.
Yes.
It was rape. Couldn't tell you his name. I finally got rid of all of them because I realized that what they wanted to do, I was just scared to death.
And obviously they got you back to the car or something happened.
Well, I'll tell you what. This one said, I want to have sex with you to get you to your car. And I realized right then, I said, please, I was crying. I was begging, and that even taunted them more. And
let me ask a question. I want to jump in here because this sounds like very similar to things. So in a way to what happens with acquaintance rape, you agreed, quote, and I put quotes around that, right?
Yeah.
Agreed to have sex with them because you were afraid that they would do horrible, worse things than rape, which would be possible death and whatever else.
Yeah, right.
So you submit to this theoretically, right? Now the problem comes down to is there enough proof then? Were you able to report this to the police? Is there enough proof then to prosecute? Or do you have five guys who say, we were out drinking, she wanted to have sex with us? See, that's a very horrible situation.
Their word against hers. Okay.
Exactly, because if you're frightened into submitting, that is rape too, but it leaves a lot less marks on your body.
Good point. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take final phone calls with Pat Brown, and my recommendation would have been go in there, cause a ruckus with that clerk, and maybe that clerk will call the cops, and at least you had a better chance that way. We'll be back in a moment. And welcome back to Coast with Pat Brown. Pat, time and time again, we hear stories of, somebody being accosted in front of other people and nobody does anything. Why don't they? We have a society of people who are afraid or what?
Well, yes, generally speaking. Sometimes people don't really know what's going on. We see so many times that people are like, they actually know each other and they're really vicious toward each other and they're loudmouthed toward each other and they're freaking out and fighting with each other. And you're like, you think, somebody's being harmed, and you step in and then you get beaten up. And they turn on you, both of them. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute, what happened here?
Yeah.
So I think some people are just a little shy of getting involved in something that they don't know is really, one person is a total victim. The other person is committing a crime. And other people are just chicken, period, and they don't want to get hurt. So they just run away and pretend they didn't see anything. So I think we do have a lack of people sometimes, saying, hey, I see something happening here and I got to get in there and save this person. So, that's why, we have to be very cautious ourselves not to get ourselves in these situations if we can avoid them.
All right. Next up, we go to El Paso, Texas. Jesse's turn. Hey, Jesse, go ahead.
Hey, George. Hey, Pat. Okay. First of all, I would like to state that I am an anti-racist skinhead. I am straight edge. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't do any drugs. So what do you think about the whole straight edge scene? And honestly, I think if more parents weren't so shy about their kids being straight edge, they wouldn't go out drinking or partying because they have that positive peer pressure of, hey, you got people who are straight edge. A couple of my friends are skinheads and also straight edge, and these people are very nice people. I do trust them. And what is your opinion on the whole straight edge.
I haven't heard too much about that, Pat. Do you know anything about that?
All I can say is having two mixed race kids and one black child, can't go with it. There you go.
Simple as that. All right, Jesse. Vincent, Orem, Utah. Go ahead. Hi, Vincent.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good, Vince.
Thank you for your service, by the way, brother.
Sure thing.
And Pat, you've been a fascinating guest.
Thank you.
I had a comment and a question, and I'll try to be really brief and possibly shove another comment in there real quick. But I have four daughters, a stepdaughter, and three nieces.
Wow.
So it's like an estrogen overload.
Yes, it is.
And I've been involved in martial arts for about 20 years, and I try to train all of them as often as possible. And I guess the question is, do you think exposing them to something like martial arts would cause them to have a false sense of security, or, you know, kind of move them towards violent situations?
Right. I like the fact that you're even asking that question. I've also been involved in martial arts in my life, and I did write in the book about the issue of self-defense for women.
Yeah.
And there's a difference between self-defense and martial arts. The self-defense classes that are 3 hours long, one night, you know, a couple nights, that give girls this idea that if they learn to throw a punch and a kick, you know, in 5 minutes, that they're somehow able to protect themselves. I think that stuff is terrible because it gives them a false sense of confidence. And they also don't teach the girls the idea of a weight class, you know, that you are a featherweight, you're going up against a heavyweight. When some guy jumps out of the bushes, you are going to lose. But if you take martial arts, girls take martial arts, they're going to the gym, they're sparring, they're hitting the heavy bag. They know it. They know the power of their own bodies. They know the power of other people's bodies. They know where they stand. So it can give them a good confidence, but, you know, a good martial arts program will also teach you how not to be stupid and use your martial arts in a dumb way and to, you know, overestimate your skill level and put yourself in dangerous situations. So I don't have a problem with martial arts. I have a problem with those little short self-defense classes.
Susan in Oklahoma City. Go ahead, Susan.
Hello.
Hey.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, thanks. I was wondering after if... I have a brother who's very control, you know, watches over, he's an older parent, and totally limits and watches everything that his two children do. No cable, and but she does have a smartphone, so kind of different. But I guess my question is, if after indulging, if some child is indulged in inappropriate behavior, how would you suggest that the parent would establish some kind of control and mutual respect again?
Well, you know, it does take a bit of work. I mean, because if already that child's crossed the line, you got to bring them back. First of all, you start by talking to them. I mean, really talking to them, sitting them down and being very open and very honest. I don't have a problem with that. I think sometimes parents just, they have a hard time sitting there and saying, hey, you know, I understand where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. I understand the world you live in. I understand some of the things you want to do. One of the things I point out in my book is that some of the reasons kids drink, do drugs, have sex is because, guess what? It's fun.
Yeah.
It's fun. Don't say it's because of other things. It's fun. You want to go have fun. So
You think you're going to have fun.
You think you're going to have fun. But, you know, the idea is to have fun. I think, it, you know, we'd sit down and say, okay, I understand where you're going with this, but let's look at where you're going to end up. Let's look at where other people have ended up doing this. And this is why I'm going to work with you to bring you to a place where we can find you ways to have a good time without having a disastrous time. So I think, it's not easy to do, but I think you have to work with it. And I want to point out something you were saying, we use the word controlling. There is a difference between being a concerned parent and being a controlling parent. So a controlling parent sounds like, you're just my law and I'm not going to listen to you and you're going to do what I say and I'm going to be like almost like, you know, an abusive husband, you know, I'll be an abusive parent. I'll just hang on to you and, you know, watch everything you do and creep you out. So there's a difference between being controlling and being concerned so that you set up a safe and happy life for your child.
Next up, we go to Lance in Portland, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Lance, we've got some time for you. Go ahead.
Hi, George. A long time, first time.
Thank you, sir.
Hi, Lance.
Yeah, my question was if you had any theories or ideas on who the Zodiac killer might have been and whether he might still be at large or if he's dead or incarcerated for some other crime. And
I think the police had the right guy originally.
Whoever he was, huh?
Yeah, the guy, you know, like that Jewish says there's a creepy guy who lived with his mother. I think they had the right guy. And, you know all that that little cryptology thing that's going on? Nobody could ever figure out the cryptology. I'm always thinking it's because it's bull.
Yeah.
You know, the guy just made up little pictograms and it's like he's laughing going, oh, I don't know. I don't know what it means. You couldn't figure it out because it wasn't anything, you know.
Main suspect is dead now, isn't he?
I can't remember what happened to him. The guy that lived with his mom.
Somebody died. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's, you know, it's not an atypical way for, you know, a serial killer, that situation to end up where the police know who it is, are pretty sure they know, but they just can't prove it, you know.
Do they watch them when they think they know who it is? Do they follow them like crazy?
Yeah, sometimes they do, and it's boring as heck, because what if the guy doesn't commit another crime for 2 or 3 or 5 years?
Which is possible.
Right, and they're really boring people. Serial killers are terribly boring. So if you want to sit there and watch him watch videos in his house, for 5 years.
What creates the time span between murders?
The number of things. One could be that, you know, usually they're committing a homicide when they want to get power and control back into their life. So there's usually something that happens right before, like they lose their job, their girlfriend dumps them, something happens.
Some tragedy in their life.
They want to get that feeling of, aha, I have control again.
Yeah.
And then they go on, and some of them want more control more often than others, and sometimes it depends on how scared they are of getting caught. So if the police are all over the place and they think they're going to get caught, they may just stop and not do anything for a long time. If they think the police aren't even looking at them, they may be laughing and thinking it'll be fun to go do it again.
Contrary to what we hear, they really don't want to get caught, do they?
They never want to get caught. No, mass murderers want to get, you know, mass murderers don't care because they want their name in the paper the next day.
Right, they expect to get
killers,
caught.
Yeah, they want to keep doing it as long as they can do it. Yeah, so they don't want to get caught. So when people say, oh, they want to get caught, no, they just got careless. Sometimes when you've committed the crimes for a long time, you just start getting arrogant and careless and you do something really stupid. And
overconfident.
Body in the trunk.
Iowa City, Iowa. Hey, Peggy, go ahead.
Oh, my God, I can't believe I got through.
You sure did. We squeaked you in, but you got it.
Been listening for probably 30 years.
Well, thank
you. Wow.
Yeah, long time.
I wasn't on for 30 years, so, Pat.
Well, I know. She was waiting for you, George, that's all.
That's right.
But my question for Pat, well, first of all, I wish I had known about you 15 years ago because my daughter was 14 and she was a real pain. Yeah.
Oh.
We went through a lot of alcohol,
Well, we all have some of that, and you know, no matter what, you know.
Oh, we went through a lot, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Early sex. She was on her way to being, like, valedictorian, and then,
go ahead, before we're out of time here.
Okay. My question is, you talk a lot about, the psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
None, actually. You know, this is a lot of fancy terminology people like to play around with, but quite frankly, I don't see the difference. Sometimes some people say a psychopath is one that's born that way, and a sociopath becomes that way from the environment, and there's no proof that, you know, you can prove one from the other. Other times they'll say a psychopath is kind of a low-functioning guy, and a sociopath is a high-functioning, like, educated dude. And I'm like, well, that doesn't make you two different people. That just means one had a better education. You know, how does that make you different? So I don't think there's any difference between the two of them. I think a psychopath is a psychopath is a psychopath is a sociopath.
That the Jorn van der Sloot guy who...
Jorn van der Sloot, like, for example, some people would say he's a sociopath because...
What is he?
He's a psychopath. You could put psychopath/sociopath. It's the same exact thing.
Not a serial killer.
No, he's not. He's a serial date rapist with an anger problem.
Uh-huh.
He takes these girls out because he's actually a pretty good-looking dude. He's got education. He's got, you know, family background, so he can, you know, impress girls. He takes them out on their date. He goes someplace with them, and then they don't do what he wants them to do. So I believe he killed Natalie on that beach when she said no.
With his anger.
Yeah, well, see, like, she was his girlfriend, but only for like an hour, and he got pissed off because she said no. She was trying to leave him, so he killed her. And then I believe he killed her. And then Stephanie, the girl
South America.
South America. I always forget which country it was. Stephanie Flores, they claim it was an attempted robbery. I think it's garbage. That girl did not have her pants on. And the whole crime scene reeks to me of an attempted assault on her.
Yeah.
She was gay and was not interested in sexually. And I think he was expecting to have sex with her, and she said no. And he killed her. Yeah, he killed her.
Unbelievable. Pat, good luck. Your book out there where? Is it on Amazon, this one?
Yeah. How to Save Your Daughter's Life can be found at any of the bookstores, Barnes & Noble, wherever else. And it's also on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
All right, Pat. Yeah. Thanks. Keep in touch with us, okay?
Thanks so much, George, for having me on.
Pat Brown. In February, her book on Cleopatra comes out. That ought to be fascinating as well. For Dan Galante, Gina Salvati, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lottasour, Stephanie Smith, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.